From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Denver, Colorado.
What matters is that two soldiers die every day, on average. And any way that we can end this war one day sooner is two lives saved. And I would walk 500 miles for that. I would walk 1,000 miles for that.
Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive, Army Reservist Marshall Thompson. He spent a year in Iraq working as a military journalist, the son of a former Utah mayor. He now plans to walk across his home state, the reddest in the nation, to protest war. Then an interfaith discussion on war and fundamentalism with a Muslim imam who fled Iraq in the 70s and a Jewish professor and community leader. And we'll speak with University of Colorado professor Ward Churchill. He's fighting to keep his job after a school committee recommended firing him for research misconduct. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The country's intelligence agencies have concluded the Iraq war is shaping a new generation of terrorist leaders and operatives around the world. That's one of the main conclusions of a newly declassified national intelligence estimate on terrorism written by the nation's 16 spy agencies. President Bush ordered the declassification of a four-page summary of the NIE after the contents of the report were leaked to the press. Part of the national intelligence estimate concludes, quote, "The Iraq conflict has become the cause celeb for jihadists, breeding a deep resentment of U.S. involvement in the Muslim world and cultivating supporters for the global jihadist movement." President Bush dismissed claims. The report indicates the invasion of Iraq was a mistake.
I'm not surprised the enemy is exploiting the situation in Iraq and using it as a propaganda tool to try to recruit more people to their murderous ways. Some people have, guessed what's in the report and have concluded that going into Iraq was a mistake. I strongly disagree. I think it's naive. I think it's a mistake for people to believe that going on the offense against people that want to do harm to the American people makes us less safe.
The New York Times reports nowhere in the national intelligence estimate is there evidence to support President Bush's claim the country's winning the war on terror. Democrats have called for the White House to declassify the entire NIE. Democratic Congress member Jane Harman said there's a second NIE focused purely on Iraq. Harman said, quote, "I hear it paint a grim picture, and because it does, I am told it's being held until after the November elections." President Clinton's former national security aide, P.J. Crowley, said the Iraq invasion has helped al-Qaeda and other fundamentalists.
They now have a new training ground, a new rallying point, a new recruiting tool. And because of the occupation or perceived occupation in Iraq, you're seeing the al-Qaeda movement, shift from being a relatively small, closely knit cadre of veterans from wars in Egypt or wars in Afghanistan to almost like a global movement where...
On Capitol Hill, Congressional Quarterly reports Democrats are not planning any organized effort to filibuster the controversial military commissions and detainee treatment bill, even though many do not agree with some of the specifics in the legislation. Democratic aides say they did not want to give Republicans an opportunity to paint them into a corner ahead of the November elections. One senior Democratic aide said, quote, "We're going to do what we can to limit the amount of daylight between us and them on national security issues in order to neutralize this as a political issue." Outside of Congress, opposition to the detainee bill is mounting. 31 former ambassadors, including 20 who served in Republican administrations, have warned lawmakers not to eliminate habeas corpus for prisoners. They said such a move would make a mockery of the administration's efforts to promote democracy. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch is urging Congress to reject the entire bill. The group warned the legislation will undermine the rule of law by denying the fundamental right of habeas corpus to detainees held abroad, by defining unlawful enemy combatants in a broad manner, and by limiting protections against detainee mistreatment. Human Rights Watch says the most of the bill is court-stripping provision, which would bar detainees in U.S. custody anywhere in the world from challenging the legality of their detention via habeas corpus actions. In news from Iraq, a new poll conducted by the State Department has found a strong majority of Iraqis want U.S.-led military forces to withdraw from the country. In Baghdad, nearly 75% of residents say they'd feel safer if the U.S. forces left Iraq. 65% of Baghdad residents favored immediate pullout. The poll shows a deep divide between the residents of Iraq and its political leaders. Earlier this week, Iraqi President Jalal Talabani called for the United States to permanently keep two air bases inside Iraq. The Pentagon has awarded the Lincoln Group a new two-year $1 million contract to monitor English and Arabic media outlets in Iraq and to help the military with public relations. The Lincoln Group's the company the Bush administration used to plant U.S. military propaganda in the Iraqi press. In Washington, 71 people were arrested Tuesday during a series of protests against the war in Iraq. The National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance organized the actions as part of the Declaration of Peace Week. One of the protesters called Democracy Now! During the protest.
This is Pat Wheeler from Deer Isle, Maine. I'm in front of the Russell Senate Office Building in Washington, D.C. A group of citizens are trying to get in with the Declaration of Peace to deliver messages to their senators about ending the war in Iraq. The cops are not letting us by. They're standing right in front of us. I can practically touch them right now. So they say they're going to start arresting us right now.
In Afghanistan, 18 people died Tuesday in suicide bomb attack outside the compound of a provincial governor. The bombing occurred while Afghan President Hamid Karzai was in Washington, where he spoke at a news conference with President Bush.
We know our problems. We have difficulties. But Afghanistan also knows where the problem is, in extremism, in madrasas preaching hatred, places in the name of madrasas preaching hatred. That's what we should do together to stop. The United States, as an ally, is helping both countries.
A United Nations official has accused Israel of turning the Gaza Strip into a prison for Palestinians, where life is intolerable, appalling, and tragic. John Dugard, the special rapporteur on human rights in the Palestinian territory, charged Israel's security measures are in violation of international humanitarian law and amount to collective punishment. Dugard said, quote, Gaza's a prison and Israel seems to have thrown away the key. Meanwhile, the Israeli military is continuing to carry out attacks inside Gaza. On Tuesday, a 14-year-old Palestinian girl died after an Israeli airstrike destroyed a house in Rafah. 10 others were injured in the bombing. Doctors said most of the wounded were women and children. The United Nations has determined up to 1 million cluster bomblets discharged by Israel remain unexploded in southern Lebanon. Cluster bombs have killed at least 14 people in Lebanon since the war ended. The UN says the problem is so severe that it could prevent 200,000 displaced people from returning home for up to 2 years. Last month, the UN's humanitarian chief, Jan Egeland, accused Israel of completely immoral use of cluster bombs in the conflict. Meanwhile, a British company called Armor Group has been awarded a $5.6 million contract to clear the region of unexploded bombs and landmines. Activists from Greenpeace have blocked an oil tanker from leaving a port in the country of Estonia. The Dutch tanker is at the center of a major environmental crisis in the African nation of Ivory Coast. Last month, the tanker dumped hundreds of tons of toxic waste in the Ivory Coast city of Abidjan. The dumping has already led to 8 deaths, and tens of thousands of people have sought medical treatment after getting sick from the toxic fumes. UN experts have said the toxic waste contained the chemical hydrogen sulfide. Officials in Ivory Coast have called for the tanker to be returned to the region so it can be used as evidence. This is Greenpeace activist Yannick Vicaire.
We are here to prevent the Probo Koala to leave the port of Paliski and to ensure that the Estonian authorities are going to treat this ship as the main piece of evidence in the toxic crime of Abidjan.
The journal Nature has revealed the Bush administration has blocked the release of a government report that suggests global warming is causing stronger and more frequent hurricanes. Meanwhile, a new report published by the National Academy of Sciences has determined the Earth's temperature has climbed to levels not seen in thousands of years. The report says this warming has already begun to affect plants and animals. In news from Capitol Hill, the confirmation of John Bolton to be U.S. ambassador to the United Nations has stalled again. No vote on his confirmation is expected until November. Bolton's serving under a temporary appointment that will expire when the current Congress concludes in January. This news from China. A jailed Chinese journalist has announced plans to sue the internet company Yahoo because it handed over information to the Chinese government that led to his imprisonment. The journalist, Shi Tao, is now serving a 10-year jail sentence. In business news, Andrew Fastow, the former chief financial officer of Enron, has been sentenced to 6 years in prison. Fastow is the highest-level Enron executive to be sentenced so far. 2 years ago, he agreed in a plea deal to serve 10 years in prison, but a judge agreed to reduce his sentence. In California, a four-day trial has begun examining the legality of lethal injection. On Tuesday, a top California law official admitted state prison guards had bungled last year's execution of former gang leader Stanley Tookie Williams. In news from South Africa, Archbishop Desmond Tutu is warning South Africa is in danger of losing its moral direction. He said a respect for the law, environment, and even life are missing in the country.
We need to try and recover the spirit that we had. We need to recover that incredible sense where almost everybody was saying, my commitment is to the cause. And whether I die, whether I suffer, whatever the price, I am willing to pay. And that was something that our people said.
Desmond Tutu's comments came as he spoke to reporters prior to giving the Steve Biko Memorial Lecture at the University of Cape Town. He said South Africa is not alone in facing hardships.
But we do have problems. And very serious problems. I mean, poverty, the devastation of AIDS, corruption, crime. But which country doesn't have problems? And people forget what we were just 12 years old. And when you think, say, America, it's been free for 300 years. What does Katrina reveal? Huh? You go to New Orleans after Katrina and you see some horrendous things that you wouldn't have expected in a country that is the only superpower.
Back in the United States, a federal judge has ordered a new trial for Judith Clark, the former member of the Weather Underground. Clark is serving a 75-year-old sentence in connection with the 1981 robbery of a Brinks armored truck in which a guard and two policemen were killed. The judge ruled Clark deserves a new trial because she was not represented in the courtroom during her first trial. Clark had served as her own attorney, but was often not in the courtroom. And finally, an update from a story Democracy Now! Covered yesterday. Army medic Agustin Aguayo turned himself in on Tuesday at Fort Irwin in California. He'd refused to return to Iraq and went AWOL. Aguayo held a news conference before he turned himself in.
Why am I turning myself in? Because it is the right thing to do. It is the responsible thing to do. I'm not a deserter or a coward. I just felt that I needed to be unavailable for this movement because I have come to believe that that is so wrong.
Agustin Aguayo, the military medic who applied for conscientious objector status, was refused, went AWOL, now turned himself in. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear our conversation with him and his wife, Helga. Those are the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, reporting from Denver, Colorado. Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive. Army reservist Sergeant Marshall Thompson spent a year in Iraq working as a military journalist. He reported from across Iraq, interviewing thousands of U.S. soldiers. now back home in his native Utah. He's planning a 500-mile walk across the state to protest the war and call for withdrawal of U.S. troops. I spoke with Sergeant Marshall Thompson on Monday in Salt Lake City in his first national broadcast interview. He began by talking about why he plans the walk.
Well, I got back from Iraq about 2 months ago, and I knew I'd have to do something to make things right. And so I decided, my wife and I, that it would be a good idea to do a walk through Utah. Utah's my home state, and I love it. It's also the reddest state in the nation. It's kind of a symbol of the last bastion of support for the war. So I thought that if I could walk through Utah in a peaceful manner and show that there's support in Utah for peace, then that just might be what turns the tide.
What did you do in Iraq?
I was a military journalist. It was a great job. I got to travel all around Iraq and interview thousands of soldiers. So I really got a good idea of what's going on over there.
You were editor of the Anaconda Times?
That's correct.
What is the Anaconda Times?
It's a newspaper. It's a military publication. It's for the largest base in Iraq.
And who ran it?
Well, there's a unit, a public affairs unit, and I was part of that unit.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to print anything you wanted in the Anaconda Times?
No, we were not able to print everything we wanted. We tried. We saw our mission as supporting the troops, so we were always trying to give them the good information and what was really going on, because they know what's going on. They're not being fooled by anybody. And so we wanted to be credible with them and print everything that happened. Of course, there is a level of censorship when you're working for the U.S. Army. It's just the way it goes.
Like what? Give an example.
There were a few times I wanted to do some stories about how, for instance, Turkey was sending special forces over the border to attack Kurdish groups, you know, without permission, violating, Iraq's sovereign borders. I was kind of outraged, and I wanted to print that story, but that was one that got squashed.
By who?
By my commanders, and they're all very well-intentioned, but nobody wants to get in trouble. And that was a story that looked like trouble, and so it did not make it.
Turkey, a U.S. ally, attacking the country that the U.S. is occupying.
Exactly. Plus, it was kind of, they were using the same rationale that we used to go into Iraq, saying, well, they've got a terrorist problem. If they can't handle it, then we'll go in and help them with it. And so we have no moral high ground there. We couldn't tell them not to do it, and they continue to do it to this day.
Marshall, why did you join the military?
I love my country, and I really wanted to serve it.
And when did you join?
I joined in 1999.
Before the 2001 attacks?
Yes. I was deployed to Kosovo during the 2001 attacks. And I've been very proud of my service. And it's just been a hard time in Iraq because this war is unjust. And no amount of patriotism that I have can change that.
How did you come to the conclusion that it's unjust?
Well, it happened before the war started. I was on the fence, and when Colin Powell addressed the UN, I believed him, like most people did, I think. But then there was something in me that kept bothering me, and it was that the decision to go to war with Iraq was based on fear. Fear of something that hadn't happened yet. And those are never good decisions. We can't make fear-based decisions. So I decided that even if they had weapons of mass destruction, that I was going to be opposed to the war. Then, years later, when I went to Iraq, spent a year there, saw what happened, it was only reinforced. And I knew that I was going to have to come home and do something to make it right for my participation in it, and just because I feel more responsible for what goes on over there, having been there for 1 year.
You interviewed hundreds of soldiers?
Thousands.
Thousands of soldiers,
yes.
In Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
What is their attitude to the war?
Most soldiers want to withdraw. That is proven. There was a Zoghbi poll, 72%. Of recently returned Iraqi vets want to be out of Iraq by 2006.
2006?
By 2006. That means this year. And my experience backs that up, absolutely. There is a lot of pressure for soldiers not to speak out. There's fear of court-martials, there's fear of their commanders getting mad at them. There's a lot of reasons why soldiers don't speak out. But nobody should be fooled. Soldiers know what's going on over there, and they're not happy about it.
What was the response when the soldier asked Rumsfeld about why they weren't being protected?
We loved it. We thought that, score one for the little guys.
Did you write about it in the Anaconda Times?
No, we did not.
Why not?
Well, it happened just a little bit before we got there for one reason. And also, that's the kind of thing that you just can't get by. a military publication.
Did you see any kind of challenging of the supervisory officers by the lower-level soldiers?
Absolutely. Constant challenging, especially on the issue of censorship. Also, that there's, like I said, a lot of people, I think, underestimate soldiers. We know what's going on. We're smart. We read the newspapers. And there's a lot of orders that may be unlawful that are challenged. You don't hear about those because those are the good examples. And then sometimes there are unlawful orders and they're followed, and that's the biggest problem.
Were you able to follow up on atrocities like Haditha, like Mamundia, that story of Stephen Green and the other army soldiers who went into the home of this 14-year-old girl, Abir, and killed her and her mother, father, and sister?
We were not able to follow up on atrocities such as those. I was able to post a blog. It kept me sane for the year because I could print anything I wanted to on my blog.
How do you do that in the military?
I just did it.
What was your blog?
It was called Chokehold in Iraq. That's my nickname in the military. It's a long story. But
Chokehold?
Chokehold, yeah.
What's the story?
I was in basic training, and they picked me because I was soft-spoken, and they picked the biggest guy in the unit, and they were going to have us wrestle. And everyone thought I was going to die, and I put him in a chokehold. And everyone thought that was really funny, that I won. So they called me Chokehold for the rest of the time.
So your blog is called Chokehold in Iraq.
Yes. And I was able to print a lot of things that I couldn't do in the newspaper, and it was very satisfying for me. Near the end of my tour, they said, hey, you've got to register your blog, and we're going to have to start reviewing your articles. And that's when I stopped doing it.
Other soldiers were doing this?
Yes. Soldiers love to blog.
What about the story of the website that would give soldiers pornographic images if they would send in pictures of horror, of atrocities in Iraq?
Yes. Well, obviously, we weren't able to print anything about those websites. Although my experience with a lot of soldiers was that they take thumb drives, they have it on the hard drives of their computers, of hundreds of pictures, small videos of terrible things that have happened, of just terrible atrocities. And it's really sad, and it's... I think if people knew that this is what's happening to their young men and women over there, that they're being exposed to this kind of a culture where you share videos and pictures like that, I think they'd be horrified, and rightly so.
So we're going to walk across Utah. How are you going to do this?
One step at a time. It's going to be 500 miles. I'll walk about 20 miles a day. Originally, I'd planned to walk one day for every 100 soldiers who have died, so it would be 26 days. However, since we've planned this, the number has increased to over 2,700 U.S. casualties in Iraq. And so I'm going to have to add a day at the end, unfortunately.
It's called A Soldier's Peace?
Yes.
P-E-A-C-E?
Yes.
And who will walk with you?
Well, we've got a lot of support. Anyone's invited to walk with me. We want this to be an inclusive event so that maybe you're a conservative and maybe you like the war, but you just think that we need a plan to get out. I want those people to come walk with me. Because at this point, it doesn't matter why we got into the war or what the partisan politics were about. What matters is that two soldiers die every day, on average. And any way that we can end this war one day sooner is two lives saved. And I would walk 500 miles for that. I would walk 1,000 miles for that.
We just interviewed the mayor of Salt Lake City, Rocky Anderson,
yes.
Who gave a very powerful speech against President Bush when he was here in the reddest state, Salt Lake City. Your dad's the former mayor of Logan, Utah.
That's correct.
His attitude to what you're doing?
At first, he was a little bit hesitant because he's so moderate. He was a little bit worried about his war protester son going out, and he was worried about my safety and things like that. But as I explained to him our point of view, which is we're just calling for a rational, responsible withdrawal from Iraq. It can start immediately, but it doesn't mean that we have to pull all the troops out immediately. But it can start immediately. Once I explained this to him, he got really excited, and he told me that he thought it was a very noble idea. And he's been a great help ever since.
Other soldiers, will they walk with you?
Yes, there will be other soldiers walking with me. I've received an enormous amount of support from fellow soldiers. I got an email yesterday from a soldier in Iraq who said, I know what you're saying. I can't publicly support you because I'm afraid of what might happen to me, but thank you for what you're doing, and I'll be walking with you in spirit.
Are you worried about walking here in Utah?
You know, some people are worried. I'm not worried. I spent a year in Iraq, and I cannot be afraid of anything in Utah. It just doesn't make any sense at this point.
If people want to get more information, where do they go?
They can go to asoldierspeace.com.
Sergeant Marshall Thompson. We talked to him yesterday in Salt Lake City. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. We gotta have peace to keep the world alive and war to cease. We gotta have joy true in our hearts with strength we can't destroy. People hear us through our voice, the world knows there's no choice. We're begging, save the children, the little ones who just don't understand. Give them a chance to breathe their young and help purify the land. People hear us, through our voice the world knows there's no choice. Curtis Mayfield, we got to have peace. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado, as we continue our 80-city Breaking the Sound Barrier tour. Tonight we'll be in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Tomorrow in Taos, midday, and in the evening in Albuquerque. On Friday, we'll be back in Denver, and on Saturday in Lincoln, Nebraska, and in the evening in Kansas City. Sunday, we'll be in Baltimore. This is Democracy Now! As we continue with our next segment, President Bush is again on the defensive over the war in Iraq. On Tuesday, the president was forced to release parts of an explosive classified national intelligence estimate that had been leaked to the media. The report says the invasion of Iraq has increased the overall terrorist threat by spawning a new generation of Islamic radicalism. The intelligence estimate represents the consensus view of the 16 spy services inside the U.S. government. But despite that consensus, the president is refusing to give any ground. On Tuesday, Bush said anti-war critics are naive for thinking the invasion of Iraq has made the U.S. more vulnerable to attack. It's not clear whether he included the spy agencies in that assessment. We're going to look at this issue of war and fundamentalism now from an interfaith perspective. Joining me here in Denver are two guests who've been working for peace within their communities. Ibrahim Kazaruni is a Muslim imam and director of the Abrahamic Initiative at St. John's Episcopal Cathedral here in Denver. He was a dissident in his native Iraq, fled at the age of 15 after being repeatedly imprisoned and tortured by the Ba'athist regime for his beliefs. Robert Prince also joins us. He's a senior lecturer at the Graduate School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's publisher of Colorado Progressive Jewish News and a member of the Colorado Jews for a Just Peace. We welcome you both to Democracy
Pleasure
Now!
To be here.
Pleasure.
Let's start with you, Ibrahim Kazaruni. When we spoke, I think it was a few years ago in Boulder, we were really talking about the conclusion of this intelligence estimate that has come out now, not knowing about the national intelligence estimate, but about the Iraq war increasing terror.
Yes, I do remember that, Amy. I mean, it's an irony that after 2.5 years or so, the 16 spy agencies conclude in the same manner that myself and a few others concluded at the time, that occupation of Iraq is going to create the opposite of what this administration wants, create the ideal situation for the terrorist organizations to recruit. And events later on after our interview actually showed that people in Saudi Arabia were captured, terrorists in Saudi Arabia were captured in Kuwait and other Gulf states, and after, through interrogation, they actually indicated that they were trained in Iraq. So Iraq has become a hobnob of terrorism in the Middle East.
Do you feel there's more of an opening now to talk about this, to criticize what is going on, the policy?
The regime, particularly George Bush and his assistants, I mean, Cheney's and Rumsfeld, are not prepared to admit or, as you indicated, give ground at all. So they are not prepared to even accept that the failure of their policy in Iraq has created this. But at least outside the administration, people are beginning to turn around and look at this issue seriously. And come to the conclusion that it is a classic example of blowback.
Robert Prince, you're with Colorado Jews for a Just Peace. As you look at the Middle East right now, sometimes you and the imam travel to talk about the situation. Can you talk about what's happening in Iraq and how you feel the bombing of Lebanon fits into this story?
Well, you know, the pieces are connected. So the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, the Israeli-Palestinian situation are all part of an attempt at the moment of the United States and the Bush administration to reshape the Middle East according to its own liking. The key element in it has to do with oil, has to do with using the Middle East as a region to put pressure on China, so that the plan should be looked at in its entirety.
What do you mean, put pressure on China?
Well, if control of Middle East oil at this point in time puts pressure on China, puts pressure on Western Europe. And the United at a time when oil resources we're facing an impending oil crisis, to control the oil of the Middle East in the way the United States wants to do it, and basically to turn back what has been 30, 40 years of nationalization of oil resources. This is not only about oil, but it's about basically retaining hegemony over the long run. So that's the policy, and it's being implemented in a military fashion. And one can say that this policy is a failure in every aspect. So there's that part of it. In terms of where Lebanon fits in the war in Lebanon, you know, during the war, we heard the leader of Nasrallah say that there was a plan that was part of a U.S. plan in the region. Later, Seymour Hersh said more or less the same thing, that a plan had been unfolded that before attacking either Syria or Iran, that the United States was encouraging Israel to, quote, take out Hezbollah and Hamas. And that plan not only did it not work, but it led to a debacle, a great human tragedy in Lebanon, and a stalling, if you like, of this initiative right now. Mm.
Ibrahim Kazaruni, the United Nations has determined up to 1 million cluster bombs were dropped by Israel and remain unexploded in southern Lebanon. Cluster bombs have killed at least 14 people in Lebanon since the war ended. Your wife is from southern Lebanon?
Yes, she is. And not only I had to follow the events, the tragic events in Iraq during that period, I had to follow the events in southern Lebanon, particularly in the case of my wife, it was deja vu because they ran away from Lebanon after the occupation of 1982-83, where they lost family members, etc. And this is not new, by the way. In Haaretz said 1.2 million unexploded bombs in their article. But one of the problems that we have between Israelis and Lebanese is what they left in Lebanon during their occupation of between 1982 and 2000. Part of the agreement was that the Israeli government would provide Lebanese government with a full plan of where they have planted bombs, mines, and other explosives that up to now the Israeli government has refused to do so. So people are being killed, just ordinary shepherds going around being killed by the unexploded bombs that were left in Lebanon before. Now we have 1.2 million unexploded cluster bombs.
Robert Prince.
You know, most of these cluster bombs were dropped in the last 3 days of the war. They were dropped at a time when it was clear that some kind of ceasefire was going to come into effect. So the military value of dropping these bombs was quite negligible. You know, it's been defined by a number of human rights organizations as a war crime, and I agree with that. It's unconscionable.
These are the high holy days for Jews around the world. These are the holy days of Ramadan for Muslims around the world. Can you talk about how religion, Ibrahim Kazaruni, fits into this picture?
Some people try to kind of ground the dispute or the conflict between the Muslims or Arabs or Palestinians and Israelis on kind of biblical scripture. I personally disagree. Because biblical scriptures or text are neutral in a sense by themselves. It's the way you interpret them that they become, that one could use it to justify violence or one could use it to justify peace. The rabbis that go and stand in front of a tractor that is destroying or demolishing a Palestinian home, they ground their action on the same scripture that another rabbi would use to justify violence and see no innocence in say, the Palestinians or others. Likewise with the Muslim community. The Quran will be used by extremists in one way or interpreted in one way, and those who, like myself, would like to use the text to support our peaceful actions and nonviolence action is interpreted differently. I totally disagree that religion has a role to play in as far as defining it. Yes, religion and religious rulings and texts will be used by people to justify their position. We had a meeting just over a month ago at DU where myself, a Christian minister, and Rabbi Wasko, we were discussing the same issue. I tried to explain that it is contemporary politics that shapes the conflict, and then religion is brought into it to legitimize or justify one thing or the other.
What is the significance of Ramadan?
Well, it's the month for soul-searching, reflection, and contemplation, decisions and for one's life. And generally speaking, it's a month of spirituality and reflecting on that dimension of it, although it has what we call social aspects and other aspects, but it's purely a month that we have a number of traditions that says the person that goes into the month has to be totally different from the person that comes out.
You fast every day?
Well, I normally fast a couple of months before the month of fasting, yes. Hmm.
And Robert Prince, these are the high holy days. Mm-hmm. Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish high holy day, the 10 days in between, and then Yom Kippur, which will be Sunday to Monday. The significance of this period for Jews.
Well, Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the new year, and the Jewish new year, and Yom Kippur, a day of atonement, also a day to reflect upon problems that we've created for ourselves and what can be done about it.
What about this issue of religion and politics? Did you feel pressure around the time of the bombing of Lebanon to hold back criticism?
I think that it was a time that for groups like the Colorado Jews for a Just Peace and for myself to show a bit of courage, and for Jews to do that in general. Of course, what happens when these wars take place in the Jewish community is that there's a strong reaction to support Israel, and that certainly happened here here in Colorado, and it happened in many places across the country. I'm really pleased that in the middle of all this, Colorado Jews for a Just Peace put out a leaflet, and we distributed it on the mall in Boulder, wrote about it, and basically our position was is quite clear and simple. Number one, that this war would not make Israel more secure; it would make it less secure. That the notion of, quote, taking out your adversaries is counterproductive. It wasn't going to happen. We predicted that it wouldn't happen, and it didn't. And that in the end, that this whole line of thinking that somehow Israel is going to solve its security problems through military might is a terrible mistake. And to try to redirect its energies towards making peace with its neighbors and making peace with the Palestinians. Within Israel, there, needless to say, the same reaction took place. That there was a kind of coming together in support of the war, but there were significant voices in Israel who, during the whole course of the war, pointed out that this war was a dead end. That it was Israel was being used to implement U.S. plans in the region, and calling for pretty much the same thing.
Last question to the imam, just 30 seconds we have left, but on Gaza, a U.N. official has accused Israel of turning the Gaza Strip into a prison for Palestinians where life is intolerable, appalling, and tragic. So said John Dugard, the special rapporteur on human rights in the Palestinian territory, charging violations of international law. Your response?
Well, it was clear when Israelis withdrew. When Sharon decided to withdraw from Gaza, he did not do so out of the goodness of his heart. It was Gaza was becoming practically impossible to control. You had 8,000 settlers vis-a-vis 1.4 million people around them in a small space. So it was tactical withdrawal. But if you read the small prints of their withdrawal, the Israelis would control the air, give themselves the right to enter the territory at any time that they wanted, control the shore, etc., etc. I mean, and as well as the borders, it literally turned Gaza into a prison. And Palestinians were saying the same thing right from the beginning, that Gaza has been turned into a prison, where before at least the Israelis had to show some kind of discretion with 8,000 settlers in there. Now they don't. They just simply have the free hand to do what they like.
We're going to have to leave it there. I thank you both for being with us. Ibrahim Kazaruni, Muslim Imam, Director of the Abrahamic Initiative at St. John's Episcopal Cathedral here in Denver, a dissident in his native Iraq who left in his teens. Robert Prince is a senior lecturer at the Graduate School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's publisher of the Colorado Progressive Jewish News and a member of Colorado Jews for a Just Peace. When we come back, we'll be joined by Professor Ward Churchill. Stay with us. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're reporting from Denver, Colorado. Our next guest has been steeped in controversy for more than a year. It began February 2005 with an article published on the front page of the Hamilton College newspaper, The Spectator. The college had invited University of Colorado Ethnic Studies professor Ward Churchill to speak at the school. The article highlighted statements Churchill made in an essay about the September 11th attacks. The essay was called "Some People Push Back on the Justice of Roosting Chickens." Among other things, the article said many of the people killed in the Pentagon and World Trade Center attacks on 9/11 were not innocent civilians. The passage that received the most attention was Professor Churchill's labeling of the people described as a technocratic core at the heart of America's global financial empire as Little Eichmanns. The controversy quickly spread, with Fox News commentator Bill O'Reilly repeatedly attacking Churchill on his television program. Soon after, Colorado Governor Bill Owens wrote a letter to the university calling for Churchill's resignation. A special panel at the university immediately conducted an investigation into Churchill's comments. They concluded he could not be fired for his statements, which were protected by the First Amendment. However, another panel later determined Professor Churchill plagiarized and fabricated material in his scholarship and recommended his dismissal. In June, Boulder interim chancellor Phil DiStefano announced that he wanted to fire Churchill. Professor Churchill is currently appealing the committee finding, and he joins us now in the studio in Denver. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Would you agree with that? A summary of what you've been through over the past, well, about a year and a half now.
Generally speaking, as sort of an abbreviated version.
What is your response to the panel finding at University of Colorado recommending, it was five people recommending that you be fired? Two of them did not make that recommendation. They recommended suspension, but three did.
Well, there's several things I would make of it. First, the investigators, in their report, which is a published document at this point, committed egregious examples of everything they accused me of having done, including fabrication, suppression of evidence, disregarding of inconvenient facts, plagiarism, false assertion of authorship, and on and on and on.
How did they engage in that?
Well, on plagiarism, basically by plagiarizing, just taking one of the essays that formed the basis of a complaint from the interim chancellor, stripping of it its annotation, presenting it as their own. And that's not simply a matter of doing it, but of saying that they had come up with the information that was in the original essay. That qualifies on AHA standards grounds and every other set of professional standards that I'm aware of that preside in the academy. You don't assert co-authorship to a book that was written before you were born. You may have a hand in editing it, but you're not a co-author. That's a false assertion of authorship. Suppression of evidence, for example, with regard to the so-called Fort Clark incident, the smallpox epidemic of 1837, I presented them with information that what I said had been said in print by prior authors. They're right, they're wrong, but I could not have invented what was already in print. They disregarded that altogether.
Why don't you explain that allegation that they have made, specifically that you fabricated evidence that Native American leaders were given small blankets infested with smallpox. They concluded that you'd committed repeated and deliberate academic misconduct, saying that you were disrespectful of American oral traditions in your writing about the smallpox outbreak.
Well, I don't know what to say about that other than just bald assertion. The problem that they had in that count was that I contended all along. This is the grounding that I come from. This is fairly well known, not a great mystery, that I'm coming from an indigenous perspective, lived experience, and directly from grassroots understandings of historical phenomena, events. They interviewed several people from the tradition of the peoples most directly affected by the 1837 smallpox epidemic, discovered to their dismay that the history of those peoples confirms essentially what I said.
And you said?
I said that it was deliberately induced
by
United States Army. Probably a little too narrow a statement was the War Department rather than the Army. But I understand the Army to be a subpart of the War Department, so there's no inconsistency with reality there.
And how did they infect the people?
Blankets.
And how did...
Possibly with garments as well. There's possibly more than one source of the infection, in the sense that various things were distributed over a two-week period of time that caused the smallpox to act in the particular ways that it did. We're getting into details now. Maybe, maybe not. But the general understanding that I presented on several occasions in my written work is entirely consistent with Mandan and Rikra Hidatsa. That's the three peoples most immediately affected in the epidemic. Conforms to their history, their historical understanding. That's not convenient, so basically glossed the point that there was ample interpretive data to support what I'd said, and announced that I was disrespectful to the tradition that I represented. This after hearing representatives of the people say that they're glad that I said it, because it is how they understand the situation. So basically you have an assertion of orthodoxy. It's all well and good to tell school children that smallpox blankets were used by the United States, leave it vacuous, dangling, unsupported, no one knows where or when, and so long as you leave it in that kind of an ambiguity, it's okay. That's scholarship. But tie it down in consistency with an actual indigenous oral tradition, and that's fraud.
Professor Churchill, the whole controversy that has swirled around your genealogy. Now, I think the committee actually threw that out.
Yeah.
But the National American Indian Movement has said that Ward Churchill received an associate membership from the United Kitu'a Band of Cherokee Indians in Oklahoma. He was not eligible for tribal membership due to the fact he does not possess certificate of degree of Indian blood. What about this whole controversy? Then the news publications going after you, I think it was the Rocky Mountain News that identified 142 direct forebears of you that turned up no evidence of a single Indian ancestor among them.
When you have binary choices that are allowed and someone else is recording your ethnicity, okay, if you're of part descent Indian and part descent white and there's land issues involved, often people would be recorded as white. On the other hand, if you happen to be of any descent black, the rest of you could be Indian. In this eugenics formulation that we're dealing with here, under the one-drop rule, you would be simply recorded as black. Basically, it's the imposition of a completely alien mechanism of identifying members in accordance with a eugenics code that is employed for the benefit of those doing the imposing. And those doing the imposing were not Indians. Indians are not simply a racial group. In fact, may not be a racial group per se at all. Culture, nation, allegiance, membership, very complex system reduced to blood quantum with someone else doing the recording according to their standards.
What about the fact that AIM is saying this, the American Indian Movement?
We're the American Indian Movement. You'd be talking to a couple of other people. The American Indian Movement is a very decentralized, organic, community-oriented movement, not an organization. What you're talking about is a nonprofit corporation chartered under the state of Minnesota, purports to be the representative of somebody else's nation. There's 400 indigenous nations, so I don't know what national AIM purports to be representing in national terms. Somebody else's country, the colonizing country. We're a national liberation movement.
Professor Churchill, what happens now? The committee made the recommendation. Are you receiving support from your colleagues?
From some. It's a mixed reaction. Frankly, the bulk of my colleagues are trying to make up excuses to get out of the line of fire themselves, and I find that to be a somewhat understandable situation, but not really something that is in conformity with adherence to the principle of academic freedom, the protections of tenure, the whole structure that allows autonomous scholarship to occur is in jeopardy. When they can take a senior professor and run this kind of a charade in order to revoke tenure into silence, when it's transparently the case that the entire investigation was convened on an to scrutinize speech, and they made no bones about it. And DiStefano made the announcement, said, we're going to examine every line he's ever written, everything he's ever said, at least insofar as it's been recorded, to see if we can find evidence that he has crossed a line.
And the charges of plagiarism?
Charges of plagiarism are themselves fraudulent.
Because?
Well, number one, because the person supposedly plagiarized refused, even in the course of the investigation, to say that she believed that I did it personally. I've denied it. The uncontradicted evidence is the fact that it was done probably by a committee. I copy edited the material when I was asked to do it, and it was sent in. That's all. Copy editors are not responsible for going back and seeing if someone else has said what it is that's included in the text. If you did that, every newsroom copy editor in the country would probably be up on some kind of plagiarism charges.
Will you fight to keep your professorship at the University of Colorado Boulder?
Absolutely, insofar as that professorship at the University of Colorado represents something much broader than the immediacy of my job. It represents a set of principles that have to do with the protection of the activities of scholars to engage in interpretation at their own discretion without fear of consequence and retribution. The constraint of discourse to approved parameters is something that we can ill afford, particularly at this historical juncture, to allow to happen in this country. And I'm not the only one who's been targeted. I simply am the most visible at this particular point.
And when will the final decision come down?
Well, they've got various cliche slogans out there about when the game's over, and it's not over until the last juror has cast the last vote on this one.
Professor Ward Churchill, I want to thank you for being with us. We are broadcasting from Denver. He's professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, Jen Ute. Special thanks to Chuck Skurich, David Goodman, Dennis Moynihan. Our website is democracynow.org. Tonight we'll be in Santa Fe at the Lenzic Theater. Tomorrow we'll be in Taos, New Mexico. In the evening, we'll be in Albuquerque celebrating KUNM. On Friday, we'll be back in Denver, and on Saturday in Kansas City, as well as in Lincoln, Nebraska. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.